You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest today is Alon Samoa, who is the co-founder and co-CEO of Transcend Education. Previously, he served as Chief Schools Officer at Rocketship Education, and he's the co-author of Extraordinary Learning for All, How Communities Design Schools Where Everyone Thrives. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Alon Samoa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Should we note when we're recording this? I think we should.
Today is November 6th, 2024.
Yeah, so at 2 p.m., and there was an election last night, I don't think we necessarily need to talk more about it. It's just, it's there in the background, and just so everyone knows that that's what's going on. I've been doing a lot of interviews with people around the future of work, and a persistent thing that has been coming up lately is that we need to redefine the whole thing. The sort of industrial age of work no longer works for work. And part of that is what we call jobs. Maybe we need to think in terms of skills instead of jobs. And I couldn't help but read, as I'm beginning to read your book, I'm like, you're kind of saying the same thing.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. And I will say that, you know, I think we experience this in our daily lives as we've seen our own jobs change and the jobs around us change, where there's both a level of commonality between what makes folks successful that are a combination of technical and adaptive skills.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's very present. And, you know, when we're doing the work of school design, certainly one of the lenses we put on the work is, what is the experience that a young person needs to have in order to make them wildly successful at work and have, you know, a thriving career and all of that? But we also put other lenses on, yeah. Like the science of learning. What do we know about motivation and cognition? We also put the lens of, what literally do students and families say they want?
Yep.
And what's amazing and very heartening is that even just those three categories, what employers and the workplace needs, what science says, and what students and families themselves say, they all say the same thing. They want learning environments where, you know, young people are engaged, where they're connected, where they feel empowered. And it is those kinds of experiences that we think are what set people up to have the skills and mindsets and routines that will make them successful in any career.
And maybe the most profound, and I knew this before, I think, but most profound thing in this book for me was they need to be safe. You cannot learn, you cannot be creative if you're in your fear brain.
That's exactly right.
And we both live in Chicago, and there are lots of students who don't feel safe.
That is absolutely correct. For many different reasons.
Yeah, many different reasons.
And sometimes they don't feel safe at school. Sometimes they don't feel safe in their personal lives. Sometimes the lack of safety they have in their personal lives follows them into school or is exacerbated by school. Much of that is identity related. The list goes on and on. But what you're saying is right. It's a perfect example of the science thing that I said, yeah. Where, you know, when, you know, just very basic motivation and cognition science tells us that when you're in your brainstem, when you're in your amygdala, which is, you know, where your kind of reptilian brain or your emotional brain, that you're literally not in your what's called your executive state. And it is in that frontal lobe. It's when you're in your executive state that you use language, that you use reasoning, that you do planning. And so when you feel unsafe, as you've pointed to, you're literally unable to learn. It's not like it's harder to learn. You're just not even in the part of your brain that is doing the learning. And so it's actually, to me, a perfect example of students and families. You ask them, what's the number one thing you want to make sure is true at school? I want to feel safe. And yeah. Guess what? The science says the same thing. When you're mm-hmm. safe, you'll learn, right? So the user and the science experts agree.
So my kids both went to Waldorf schools. So here, Chicago Waldorf, which was a great experience for us. No school is perfect, but the amount of story and play and learning to learn. My son, who had a learning disability, always listened to books on tape. And of course, he's a voracious reader now. You know, they very much approach the whole child. Yeah. And that's the thing that you're pointing out in this book, that again, the industrial education system really just doesn't, when its sole focus is on these assessments, testing, grades even. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I, yeah, if, let's do a little history lesson. So the yep. current model, the predominant model of school, not Waldorf, but the predominant model of school of, you know, 30 kids sitting in rows, the teacher in the front of the room, in the schoolhouse or the school building, is what we call and others call the industrial model of school. And it really was created in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And we call it the industrial model, not only because it seems to describe it, but also because it is historically accurate, that the principles of Taylorism, which are the principles that were applied to factories, were literally and explicitly applied to schools. And actually, that made a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
If we're preparing kids for factory work, well, let's have them experience a factory. I mean, it's completely aligned, right? Yeah. And in fact, by the way, and we need to remember this, was a huge innovation at that time.
Yeah.
You know, at the turn of the century, 6% of students attended formal high school. Right. And so that in and of itself was an innovation. The problem is that, as we've already talked about now, as the needs of the workforce and what we know about scientists and what the users say changed, the model did not. And so that's why experiences like Waldorf, et cetera, are, you know, the exception and not the rule. And then as we started figuring out, wait a minute, there's a lot of gaps in learning. Some kids aren't learning to read. And actually, kids furthest from opportunity, kids that have been marginalized, et cetera, are the ones that are falling the furthest behind, et cetera. Then, you know, out of the right intention, the kind of assessments and standardization came out. Now, I would say that in and of itself, the idea that we are assessing to what extent important things are being mastered is part mm-hmm. of what we do to reflect on the effectiveness of things is a good thing. The problem mm-hmm. is when we only do it on a very myopic set of things, right? Like, I certainly want my kid to do reading and math. I like the standards. It's great. And I want them to be loved. And I want them to know how to advocate for themselves. And I want them to know how to make people who are other, not like them, feel comfortable, both because I think that's what humanity needs. And also, I know they're going to need those skills in life, right? To be successful. And unfortunately, that industrial model didn't change with the times. And that's sort of at the core of what we're doing. So yes, whole child is a huge part. It's one of the, what we call one of the leaps of learning that we think we need to make from the industrial model to more, you know, future current models. But it's because the thing just hasn't changed since it was first designed.
So companies bring us in, we do 450 engagements a year, and more we're getting brought in because what they're discovering about their workforce is they don't know how to collaborate. Mm-hmm. They don't know how to problem solve. They don't know how to disagree in a way that won't end up with, you know, folded arms, staring, stomping off kind of thing. They are not resilient. And what we just sort of discovered is like, yeah, their education up to even going in the workforce was not preparing them to do work. And I don't know, like, I don't necessarily think it was better in my schooling age. I don't know. I mean, it's, but also I had in tremendous support and was involved in theater and all the other things that give you, you know, that very privileged in terms of that education. So, like, is it worse now? Has it always been like this? What's, where are we at?
Yeah. I don't think it's worse. Okay. It's not like I was, you know, I went to schools in LA, probably the best that LAUSD has to offer, because my, you know, very, very assertive Iraqi Jewish mother, like, argued her way into me being in magnet schools and whatever, right? Like, yeah. But I never really learned how to collaborate. I mean, it wasn't like they were teaching me empathy. No. They were quote unquote better schools because, yes, like, the rigor was a little higher. And, you know, there was more engagement in the learning community, but it wasn't because we were doing something drastically different than the industrial model. Where I learned that stuff, and it sounds like this is true for you too, was in other things I did, you know, as part of Junior States of America, where I learned how to be part of a student-run organization around political awareness, or as a musician, where I had to, you know, figure out how to play with other musicians, how to work with them from the technical side of the music business, you know, how to work with owners, et cetera, right? Like, that's where I learned that stuff. I didn't learn it in AP biology.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, and I think here's one thing that has changed, right? There's been a devalue in terms of arts and certain kinds of extracurricular activities, recess. So play, trivializing play, which is crazy in my mind.
Yes.
You know, in terms of feeding the soul. So, and again, that seems because the incentives are off because they really need them to test well. And you can't test play, really.
Right. Well, and you're getting at something, I think, really at the heart of the matter. I also, it sounds like you are a Royal Waldorf parent. I'm a Montessori parent. It sounds like many similar reasons. And, if we're to extrapolate for a second, so the thesis that you just put forward is, look, because we're focusing on a myopic set of outcomes and incentives, it is causing schools to ignore a bunch of stuff that's really beneficial to kids. And that bundle of stuff that's really beneficial for kids, we think of as the actual experience of school.
Yeah.
And so just to put a word on that, it's like, it's not only that the outcomes, we've been talking about the outcomes are too narrow, they should focus on other outcomes like empathy, et cetera. It's also that we're focusing almost exclusively on outcomes and seeing experiences merely as, you know, paths to certain outcomes.
Yeah.
When really experiences in themselves, right, which is what you're getting at with play or with extracurriculars, but also even in a core academic class, how much agency do I have? How seen am I? Do I see an author that looks like me, et cetera, right? And so the experience of school, it should actually be at the center. You know, John Dewey, who was here in Chicago, University of Chicago, you know, famously said, education is not preparation for life. Education is life itself.
Yeah.
And if we really sit on that with that concept, it I think provides a window into a different way of orienting to what we're trying to improve in school. And I can talk more about the different kinds of experiences that we think need to change. But as a category, I would say what's powerful about it is literally what students are seeing today. It's what they feel today. And they can tell us how it's going. So if we're looking for measures, if we're looking for ways of knowing, well, is this experience worthwhile? We have more data, quote unquote, than one test that happens at the end of the year or longitudinal data about employability, right? Like, this is happening right now. They can tell us right now whether they're feeling seen, whether the work is, you know, at the right level of challenge, whether they feel agency over their work, et cetera, et cetera.
So let's jump into that in terms of some of the examples, because you highlight some schools that are kind of doing this in interesting work. And one of them, and the first you talk about the book, is the Van Ness Elementary School in Washington, D.C., And you talk about this child who you call Jalissa as she arrives at the front door of the elementary school. What happens to her?
Yeah, so the experience that she has is one where she is feeling accepted and seen and loved every step of the way, literally, like as she enters the building, including before she enters the threshold of the classroom, where she's met with a greeting. She's given a choice about what kind of greeting she wants from the adult, because the science tells us a healthy adult attachment routines build, you know, get students into their executive state. And then when she sits in her morning circle, which is called, there's a routine called Strong Start, where there's some, you know, community practices that connect students together, where they set intentions, where they do some breathing and meditation. The things that when we are our best as adults, right, where we, when we feel connected and calm, are able to do our best work. What's really interesting about the story with Jalissa is that Van Ness Elementary is a school in D.C., Washington, D.C., that was reopened. And because it was reopened, there were kindergartners and first graders that were enrolling in the school, some of whom had literally been suspended or expelled from other kindergarten, you know, their other elementary schools. And the principal, Cynthia Robinson Rivers, and her surrounding community basically said, this is not going to be a school where that happens, right? Uh-huh. And then, predictably, students started exhibiting some of the behaviors that got them expelled. And we really asked ourselves, what is it that needs to happen, right? Like, let's actually center the child. What is it that a child needs? And it is from there that we brought in evidence-based practices from, you know, different learning environments, et cetera, that helped us land on that experience that Jalissa would have. And that includes when Jalissa does have a potentially disruptive moment, and is bringing some of that trauma and is in her, even with all of these proactive measures. And what happens then? Right. And I mean, it really was such a striking thing. And we've seen many examples of it at Van Ness and other schools that are using their model, where another student calmly helped Jalissa to the calming corner in the room, helped her identify off a chart what emotion she was feeling. And together they did a kind of calming and grounding practice. And there was no disruption to learning, right? Now, I've been to thousands of classrooms across the country. Normally what happens is disruption, lots of people, the
escalates
from the teacher to every student having their, you know, all sorts of chemicals being released in their brains that put them back into their emotional or their brain stem state. And, you know, with lots of disruption to learning, actually, right? And usually then leading to punishment, which then leads to a whole cycle, right? Because we know that suspensions, especially early on, you know, are, you know, the first step in the school to prison pipeline. Like, it's a whole thing. And here, in a very simple, caring moment, not only does Jalissa get what she needs, but that student who was her mentor in that moment, what did she learn? And what did all the other students around them? And how much easier is the teacher's job as a result? Right. And so it is that kind of design that is centering the whole child that feels like just one example of the kinds of very intentional choices we can make, both proactively and reactively, to make learning more relevant for the kind of learning we want today.
You know, people talk about this stuff as if it's soft. And I get that. It's you're being potentially soft with someone. It is really hard to do it. And I mean, you know, it is no picnic being the guy who wrote the Yes And book and being a parent, because you're get called out on your crap right away. It's like, oh, well, all right, guess we're not Yes Anding. And I remember I don't know if I've told the story on the podcast. I'll tell it really quickly here. But my daughter, Nora, I think she's around 7, and she wanted a raise, and she did not deserve a raise in her allowance. She wanted one. And I had to yes and it. So I said, yes. And if you can tell us a good reason, give us a good case for why you deserve the raise, we will consider it and give it to you. And it happened in the morning. I hadn't thought about it. And at night, my wife and I were getting ready for bed. And Nora comes in, and she's wearing one of my suit coats. She's crudely put a tie around her, and she has got a PowerPoint for me, which is construction paper, going why she deserves this. It was so creative and so funny, she got the raise. And it only happened because I chose a yes and as opposed to a no. I chose to actually make it a moment, a good moment. And we have that agency, but it is hard. I don't want to, like, it's to be in that state all day long takes immense strength.
It sure does. It sure does. And that's why right now in a kind of typical industrial model of school, we place the entire burden of creating moments like that on the heroic educator in the room.
Yeah.
And there's only so much hero anyone can bring to any situation.
Yeah.
As opposed to the design of the thing doing some of the work, right? I mean, that's what's powerful about, you know, Waldorf Montessori environments is, you know, in Montessori, there's literally a phrase, which is one, like, the classroom is a teacher. Like the way you set up the classroom, how it's set up, is there a place to sit? How's calming is it? You know, can kids access it themselves so that they can take things and put them back?
All choice that architecture.
It's exactly. Choice. Right. You know, and those those are jobs to be done that the human educator now doesn't need to worry about and can focus on the things that they are uniquely positioned to do. So you're right. This stuff is hard, and that's why it takes such intentional design.
It's funny because you can also see. So we have a Starbucks in the building here, and they started employing torture architecture, so people wouldn't stay there. And then you wonder why Starbucks is like all like, oh, well, business is down. I'm like, yeah, you literally took your third place and threw it away.
Right.
There's a great quote in this section of the book from one of the teachers. Anissa Blunt, where she says, quote, there's a tremendous amount of learning to do as a teacher, but no one tells you how much unlearning is required too.
Yes.
That's it.
It's so huge. I mean, I mean, that's one of my favorite quotes too, because it speaks to one of the main challenges we have. So if we kind of track our conversation, we're saying, look, there's an industrial model of school. It needs to somehow change to something, you know, that's more centered on the child, on the whole child, broader set of outcomes, experiences that we really care about. Well, then how do we do it? And what is with us and what is against us in that effort? And one of the things that's against us is that we all have this archetype of school that we've deeply internalized about what it's supposed to be. And so, you know, it takes a lot of effort for even an educator to think differently about what school could or should be, how it could be designed differently, because, you know, we spend 15,000 hours in school between K and 12. That's 15,000 hours of neural pathways that are reinforcing this is what school is, multiplied by however many parents, etc. And so part of the how, which is why we spent a whole book on this, it requires a community not just to like make some new design choices as if you were making, you know, remodeling your kitchen, But to actually do the adaptive work, the learning work and unlearning work required to even give yourself permission to see a different way, let alone to start seeing the path forward. And, you know, some of the things that we do, like some of the tools that we use for that kind of unlearning include, for example, doing empathy interviews. So that teacher was quoted in the book, most likely had a moment where she had a 45-minute conversation with a child, and she only spoke for 3 of those minutes, and the kid talked for 42 of the minutes with a kind of structured, you know, interview guide with lots of open-ended questions and not leading and whatever. And, you know, educators that do this many times will say, that's the first time I ever talked to a kid for 45 minutes, and I've been a teacher for 15 years, right? Yeah. It's not in the job description to do that. And usually when we're talking to kids, we're doing more of the talking, right? Mm-hmm. As adults. And so that's the kind of unlearning when you just sit with like, okay, I might have this archetype that I built over 15,000 hours in my education degree, but I have a student sitting here telling me they don't feel like they get to choose anything. And they don't feel like they can learn in my class, right? And, you know, and then you pair that with, and let's read some science on it. And we pair that with going to a different kind of learning environment where it seems like things like that are, you know, on the plus side. And you start to do the unlearning that you're talking about. And that's referenced in that quote where now as a community, especially if it's not just one teacher's thing, but as a community, we're going through that journey. We're starting to really be able to interrogate questions like, what's the purpose of school? How do we center our students? How can we, you know, put the sacred cows out to pasture while keeping our core assets, et cetera.
Another school that you highlight is right here in Chicago called Intrinsic Public School. And they do a thing called Choice Day, which I think they said that came from Northside College Prep.
Yeah.
They
started building it. That was the idea. And then they built on top of it. Exactly.
I live right by there. Tell us about this school.
Yeah. So Intrinsic I love so much about the school. As a side note, my son is applying to high schools next year's in eighth grade. And I had the joy of bringing him to Intrinsic mm-hmm. as he considers that on his list of schools to go
wow.
to,
great.
Which would be so amazing and such a full circle for me personally. Intrinsic was already doing some, you know, pretty innovative things in terms of their instructional model, et cetera. But one of the, you know, most optimizing, optimism inspiring things about Intrinsic is that they never stop learning. So, and I think this is an important point of the how before I get to the Choice Day, which is we're not trying to replace the 100-year-old industrial model of school with a new 100-year model of school,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We're trying to replace it with a model that continues learning about itself and is iterating, just like happens in every sector. We would not accept iPhone 16 to look like the first iPhone, but we totally accept the classroom looking the same year. Okay, so one of the things that they realized as they did some of this empathy work with kids, et cetera, is that they did feel like students needed more agency, right? And also more resourcefulness. So in a perfect example of triangulating what students say they want and what the science says with what the future demands, I remember Melissa talking about conversations that she had with the head of the community colleges in Chicago, who said something to the effect of, you know, there are kids that come to community college that are actually like academically behind, and we have all these supports for them. I mean, like, and he started listing all the supports, and then he looked at the kind of usage rate, and he was like, no one's using it. It's there mm-hmm. and no one's using mm-hmm. it. And a light bulb went off for Melissa and the whole team, where he said, look, so when you get to community college, what is it that gives you that agency and resourcefulness to use those things? And also, is that connected to how kids aren't feeling like they have enough choice in the day? And is that connected to the science, right? And so what they, you know, decided to pilot was a thing called Choice Day, where for half the day, students choose any academic supports that they might need, including time to just do some work on their own or collaborate on a group project, but also including getting, you know, some small group tutoring or, you know, clearing up a confusion with a teacher, et cetera, et cetera. And then they spend the second half of their day doing the play thing that you referenced before, mm-hmm. where they can, you know, they can pick a club, they can do an extracurricular. I think the idea is that over time they could go out of the building too and, you know, do internships and stuff like that. And so they have a day where they are in charge, right? And what that's done, not just for the experience and outcome related to their own agency, but also what it's done to the rest of their school, where it's like, this is a place where I'm in charge. And so even when I'm maybe a little bit less in charge, I'm still in charge, right? Mm-hmm. And so that puts me in my executive state the whole time. And I'm just more likely to learn and be set up for college and career.
How did you find your way into this work?
Me personally.
Yeah.
You know, I worked at a after school tutoring company called Score Educational Centers, which doesn't really exist anymore. What was really cool about it is that it used a computerized curriculum, which, you know, this is before the term blended learning. And because of that, it was there, we were able to run centers in both low and high income communities. So I was in New York and, you know, one day I'd be in Scarsdale, which is a high income community. And the next day I'd be in South Bronx, which is low income community. And what I saw was, that parents and kids basically want the same things, but aren't offered the same opportunities.
Yeah.
And so that led me to wanting to be part of how do we make, you know, learning more equitable, Which led me to Teach for America, where I had the chance to support the training and development of thousands of teachers across the country. And I started going to classrooms across the country. And one of the main thoughts that I had every time was, the hardest working person in this room is the teacher. And I'd say that again and again and again. And I thought to myself, but wait, aren't the students supposed to be working? Like, why aren't they working hard? Because it's, and then that led me to a whole inquiry around, wait, like, why is it even designed this way? And then I met lots of people that were having that same kind of thought. And that led me to start to see that the design of school is, you know, and maybe on this election day is a perfect day to bring this up, is not merely a way of making sure that every student has the opportunities and choices that they deserve, but also that humanity needs a different design, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, pick the social issue you care about, democracy, climate, equality, et cetera. Like, what happens in school for 15,000 hours, over the course of 55 million lives, which is how many kids are in K-12 education in the U.S., is going to make a difference. And you know, it's mine and many other people's opinion that the current design of school is not set up for what individuals or humanity needs as a whole. And so I've, you know, been lucky enough to be able to make a living on, you know, something I care deeply about.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you don't have a model that you've basically seen work in front of you that shows you something that seems structurally like, well, that's going to be like this forever. If you haven't had that model that, no, it doesn't need to be that. People change, things change, all that. I don't know how you can have the agency to dream different.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, and I think what you're sort of saying is like, no, so this is the place to do this. And you have a rural school in here. It's not just urban schools. It's like, and they all operate differently. In the rural school, kids learning blacksmithing. I mean, that's, you know, that's not going to happen in the Bronx, I don't think.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And you bring up a really important point because, so first of all, at the very basic level, yes, part of that learning journey is literally going and seeing other places to do that mind opening, that adaptive work that gets a community to see things differently. And so that's common across all communities. That need is common, but all communities are not the same. And that's why the old like top-down approach of here's the model, it's evidence-based, everyone use it now, thank you very much, just doesn't work. And the opposite, by the way, also doesn't work. They're like, well, communities should just decide for themselves and invent everything from scratch. I mean, we don't ask doctors to invent vaccines while they're serving patients. Like, why are we expecting teachers to reinvent a century-old model of school? And so this is sort of a third way where we're trying to take the best of other practices, get the learning, get the inspiration from other places, get literally the stuff that people can use that they don't need to reinvent, but also respect the uniqueness of communities and have communities go on their own journey to stitch that stuff together in ways that fit their dreams, in ways that fits their context.
How hopeful are you that these models, this thinking, can become more mainstream?
It remains to be seen. I'm a deep optimist, and it would be hard to do this work without having some measure of like, we're going to manifest this, you know, come hell or high water kind of thing. But I also know there's a lot working against us. There's nothing guaranteed about this. And so I guess what I'll say is when we're working with an individual community, I have tremendous hope.
Yeah.
Because I see the light bulbs go off. I see the learning turn into better conditions for change. And I see those conditions for change turning into different design choices that turn into different experiences and outcomes for kids. Like I see it happen, in real time. Right. And so that gives me tremendous hope. But then when I see the macro and all of the things that are against, you know, communities and this kind of work, that's daunting for sure. One thing that is, you know, more true today than it was 10 years ago is that schools are even more politicized. And more of a, you know, cudgel for the right and the left, frankly. Right. And that doesn't serve kids. And so I'm both a deep optimist and I have lots of hope, and I'm a realist that sees the challenges. But, you know, I think this is, you know, there's you know, the different versions of this in different traditions. But, you know, there's in the Jewish tradition, there's the phrase, you aren't required to finish the work, but nor are you permitted to abandon it. And I kind of have that attitude. It's like, you know, these are bricks that we're laying over time. And I may not see it all in my lifetime, but, you know, the children are our future.
Yeah. All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before I do that, I see a really sweet guitar behind you. Favorite jazz guitarists? Who are a couple of your favorites?
Wes Montgomery, yeah. Joe Pass, Django yes. Reinhardt, yes. Jim Hall. Mm-hmm. The list goes on. Contemporary ones, shout out to my friend Andy Brown here in Chicago.
Yeah, Reed Hawk in Chicago.
Oh,
also.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, we have some talented musicians.
I saw Joe Pass at the jazz showcase, and it was and Roy Brown was playing the bass. It was just like one of these amazing. I got to see Rapelli too before he passed away.
You did?
Not a guitarist, of course, but still, it's.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'm very lucky. My dad proposed to my mom at a Dave Brubeck concert when he started playing Take Five.
No way. That is incredible. Yes, I feel like we could have a whole conversation just about this. I love jazz. That is a 1946 Gibson L-48.
All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do. And so interestingly, it emanates from what we were just talking about, jazz.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really developed a love for playing music through high school and college. I was blessed with a wonderful teacher named Ted Green in LA that, you know, showed me how to think about the instrument and how to listen. I love the way it made me feel. I love the collaboration with people. I loved practicing. I loved everything about it. You know, I was lucky if I got a gig for, you know, $50. In New York City, right? You know, I wasn't in it for the money anyway. And, you know, it felt like I had a very much a choice in front of me, which was, you know, do I devote myself to a life of music and sort of, you know, as Yeats says, refuse the mansion in the dark, right? Or is there a way to do both? Mm-hmm. And I had this conversation with my mom where she said, you know, if you only do the music thing, eventually you'll have to play music not on your terms. You won't be able to pick and choose. You'll have to play that wedding whether you want to play it or not.
Yeah.
And is that going to like ruin it for you? And yeah, she had a motive for sure, but she made the point. And so I had a crossroads in my life where it was like, do I have to choose between these two, or can it be a yes and? Yeah. Can I, you know, pursue something that I'm passionate about in artistically and something that I'm passionate about from a, you know, more traditional career standpoint. And I was able to do both. And I'm happy to say that today that makes me, you know, it brings me solace. It brings me a different way of operating. They complement each other beautifully. And, you know, I still, you know, I have a Friday gig that I play every week. And, you know, it like, I feel like I've been able to live into that yes and in ways that have truly enriched my life.
I love it. The book is called Extraordinary Learning for All, How Communities Design Schools Where Everyone Thrives. Alan Samoa, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.